My name is Susan Davis, and I'm chair of the session. And what I'm going to do is make a few brief remarks and introduce the speakers so that we can get on with the heart of the session fairly quickly. In 2005, SAA Council approved the current version of the Code of Ethics, replacing the one passed in 1992. The first SAA Code of Ethics was approved in 1980, which means that the profession seems to revisit this issue about every 12 years. In between, archivists grapple with the way the code does or does not apply to specific situations in specific repositories. A code of ethics is one of the hallmarks of a profession. As Karen Benedict points out in her 2003 book, Ethics in the Archival Profession, a professional code of ethics is a public function, one which guides practitioners and also serves as a compact with the public. But there's always a conflict between ethical principles and the realities of the workplace. We tend to confuse purely ethical principles with matters of professional conduct for an individual or matters of best practices for an institution. They're very different things, and we tend to kind of conflate them when we talk about ethics. So ethics are really a piece of the puzzle, and there are no moral absolutes. The common archival adage, it depends, and Lloyd is sitting there with the it depends button on, applies here with a vengeance, as our speakers will elaborate. The SAA code focuses on the relationship between archivists and the materials that they acquire, preserve, and make accessible. It's very brief. On SAA counsel and legal counsel, counsel with a C and counsel with an S, advice, the current version of the code was designed to be aspirational. So it does not really provide much guidance in terms of either professional conduct or institutional best practice. It's pretty brief. To give you a little context, I revisited some of the other codes in, thinking about the session. The ALA code and the ACRL code of ethics for special collections librarians, they more emphasize professional conduct with much less attention to collections. Matters of access to collections are covered instead in the ACRL joint statement on access to original research materials, which is currently under review by a joint SAA-ALA committee task force. The Association of Canadian Archivists divides its code into two parts, a concise list of principles and then a section on the application of the principles arranged more by archival function. The applications portion of their code contains a section on availability and use. So let me read to you the paragraph in the SAA Code of Ethics that relates to access. Archivists strive to promote, and notice strive to promote, a little, fudging, here, strive to promote open and equitable access to their services and the records in their care, note both services and records are mentioned, without discrimination or preferential treatment and in accordance with legal requirements, cultural sensitivities, and institutional policies. Archivists recognize their responsibility to promote the use of records as a fundamental purpose of the keeping of archives. Archivists may place restrictions on access for the protection of privacy or confidentiality of information in the records. That's what the Code of Ethics says. This language is laudable as a statement of ethical principles. The question is, how helpful is that statement when dealing with real-life situations? And so that's the focus of the session. We have three speakers, each of whom will reflect on providing access to their holdings and how they have or have not found themselves in conflict with the Code of Ethics and specifically the Access Clause. The speakers will present in the order they're listed in the program, and I'm going to introduce them all in a moment. We're going to keep their formal presentations fairly brief so that the speakers have time to respond to each other and then to what we hope will be a kind of lively dialogue on some of the issues for the audience. First, let me introduce myself. I am on the faculty of Drexel University's College of Information Science and Technology, and I was a member of the Committee on Ethics and Professional Conduct when this code was drafted, which is why they asked me to stand up here and chair the session. Our first speaker is Lynn Eaton from Duke University. Lynn is a graduate of the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Library and Information Service and has worked at Duke for the last 11 years. Her responsibilities range from digital projects to technical services to project management and now reference. Lynn will speak mostly about business collections in an academic setting and the demands of acting as a corporate archives while balancing support for researchers. Our next speaker will be Sara Conway Lanz. Sara has been an archivist with the Nixon Papers at NARA for the past 3 years. Before that, he worked at Yale University. He has a PhD in history from Harvard. Sara will discuss the challenges of balancing privacy protections and access in presidential libraries and the kind of standards presidential libraries have used to implement privacy protections. Presidential libraries face particular challenges in terms of how much privacy a president should have in the face of public accountability needs. Our third speaker is Hal Kiner. Hal has been the university archivist and director of records management at Appalachian State University since 2002. Prior to that, he was a business archivist at several companies in the Hartford area and also archivist and historian for the Biltmore Company. He's a graduate of Knox College and holds a PhD in history and certificate in archival administration from the University of Connecticut. Hal will talk about how state and federal laws, such as North Carolina's public records law, FERPA, and HIPAA, shape access to records in a state university and how they sometimes conflict with the SAA Code of Ethics, or don't. I'd like to sit down now and let them talk, and then we'll get back to discussion.
Thank you, Susan, and thank you all again for coming. It's much appreciated. As Susan said, I'm Lynn. I work at Duke University, and I work in the Hartman Center for Sales, Advertising, and Marketing History, which is where this is, case study is being framed. And in the Hartman Center, basically, we have business records. We have advertising agencies, individuals who work in advertising or in business. We have print materials that deal with advertising, organizational records, such as the Outdoor Advertising Association of America. Now, we are the Hartman Center, but we are within the Rare Book Manuscript and Special Collections Library. And so we follow the standards that are created for the entire library and work within those standards to apply anything that needs special attention. And usually, there's not much that needs more special attention than something else. An author will have certain restrictions that they want applied, and businesses will have certain restrictions that they want to apply. So it's based on a case-by-case basis. And the intent for all of this is to have collections open and accessible to as many people as possible, as soon as possible. But business records of contemporary businesses are under more restrictions than historic business records because you're dealing with people who are talking about money, who are talking about other what they deem as confidential matters going between businesses, going between themselves in response to what's going on in a business setting. And usually a business is still in existence when it provides the records to us, or they've been dead for a while and then their records come to us. In the case study that I'm going to discuss, what happened was there was a company who went out of business and almost immediately provided their material to us. And so they were not really aware of all the material that was in their holdings. Another agency's records that we have is the J. Walter Thompson Advertising Agency record. Those are the company records that created basically the Hartman Center, that started the Hartman Center on its way. And they have, their restrictions are set up, and they were set up when they came in as to if anything is unpublished, it's closed for 15 years, and that's on a rolling basis. So it's always in existence. Anything that was created now is closed for the next 15 years. If it's published material, it's open immediately because everybody's already had access to it. If there are personnel files, the personnel files are closed for 25 years after the death of the employee or 40 years after their removal from the company by either retirement or firing or their own choice. And it's whatever date you can find that's most applicable. So we received the records of this closed agency. And the intake standards at that time, and they're always evolving, as I'm sure you know at your own institutions, at that time, as soon as they came in, they were open to access. There was a basic box list, a very basic box list, but that they were wide open for anybody who wanted access to it. And there were no restrictions on it because it was just given to us after the company went under. So 6 months or so after the receipt of that company's record, there was a request from a former CEO of that company to find a presentation that they had done for one of the clients. That's fine. So the reference archivist went through and looked at the box list. Okay, I can find this. And because of the broad box list. There were five boxes that she had to go through to find the information that she was looking for. And that's just an aside on MPLP. Sometimes it's not always helpful to be broad. It would have been very helpful for her to not have to do that. But at any rate, so she was going through the material, and she found memos that were created very shortly before the company went under regarding a certain client, and this client sold alcoholic beverages. And the memos that were described or that were written, which she found in there, were talking about how the agency really disliked the clients, and they were naming names, and they were saying that these people were, one, they just didn't like them, but they were homophobic, sexist, that they were only interested in doing advertisements of women in bikinis, which does sell alcohol, but, you know, might be good to vary it a little bit, and that they were also targeting underage drinkers. And that is a big legal issue. It's a big legal issue. Okay, so all the people who wrote the memos were still active in the advertising business, and all the people who those memos were about were still very active in the business that they were doing, the alcohol business company. And I don't want to give names just because it's this problem. So the Hartman Center was faced with a difficult conundrum. So here we have this collection, right, and it's here, and it's open. But it's also holding material that if the client had been aware of what they were providing, it probably either, one, would not have come to us, or two, there would have been restrictions placed on it. And so there was no one legitimately whom we could contact at the agency to say, what do you want to do with this situation? And even if there had been somebody, then it's also, or somebody appropriate, there was a concern about setting off alarm bells, so that if we had talked to the CEO, who former CEO, who was interested to say, this is what we found, this is a concern, then there was a fear on our part that they would want the collection back and close or destroy everything. And so the Hartman Center, their business, our business, is to collect business records, right? So we have a reputation to uphold. We want to be responsible stewards of business materials. And if you have been to any business archive section meetings, you'll see that there are some businesses who allow no one access to their collections, right? They're, because it's their business records. Business people can have, in the business, can have access to it, but if I'm a researcher and I'm looking for, okay, if I'm looking for Coca-Cola's secret product, they're never going to give that to me anyway. But Coca-Cola will allow some researchers in. There are some companies that will allow no one in. And so the concern on our part is to get this medium good complementary relationship going, where they will give their material to us and we will say we are responsible for you and to you in this material because we want your records to be housed here. We want people to access the material. You want your name, which is part of what we say, you want your name to be studied and to be noted in publications for many years to come, so that's a benefit to you. But it's, you know, their legal problems in any business with their records. So that was our conundrum. We have our reputation. We have the business having these memos that are damning of what was going on in that company. So the resolution was that the Hartman Center reference archivist at the time talked to the director at the time, and they consulted and they thought about it and they weighed options and went back and forth. And what they came to was that they would apply to that business the same restrictions that were applied to the J. Walter Thompson Company. So it became a 15-year rolling date for any unpublished material. All published material open automatically, and if there are any personnel records, then those personnel records are closed for 25 years after death or 40 years after the person leaves the company, again, if you can find out that information. Now, it was understood that this is a completely imperfect situation for us and for the company. There's a question as to the responsibility on the donor's part. They had no idea of what they were giving, and you would hope that the donor would have some idea, some recognition of the volatility of the material that they're going to be giving. And that's not always the case. We also have had donors who are very well aware of what was being given. We had a woman, Margaret Fishback, who is a copywriter, and she was prolific and really interesting, had lots of fun little things that she created. But she was also an alcoholic and also suffered from manic depression. And in her papers, there were numerous accounts of suicide attempts and visits to the hospital, and these are the medications she's on, and et cetera, et cetera. And her son gave the records to us, and her son said, I realize that this information is in the collection, and I want it to stay in the collection, and I want it to be available in the collection so that other people can see what my mother went through, and they can also possibly get hope from her successful life, even battling all of these addictions and issues. So that's the kind of donor that we love. It's like, great, that's wonderful, and we'll be glad to provide whatever access we can for your records. But otherwise, what we try and do is to provide some sort of modicum of responsibility towards the business and responsibility towards the university and the broader research world.
Hello. I'm here as an archivist who works at a presidential library and not as a representative of the National Archives or the Office of Presidential Libraries. What I say here today are my own thoughts and opinions and not necessarily the position of the Nixon Presidential Library or the National Archives and Records Administration. I am not, and nor have I ever been, an employee of the Nixon Foundation, which ran the private library, the Nixon Library and birthplace in Yorba Linda, California, before NARA took over that library in July 2007 and transformed it into the Nixon Presidential Library, a federally run presidential library like the other presidential libraries in the NARA system. My primary responsibility at the Nixon Presidential Library has been to process the Nixon White House tapes. My work has not so much put me into conflict with the SAA's new code of ethics as it's shown me how challenging it can be to apply aspects of the code's principles for access. To use this session's metaphor, it's not so much that the size doesn't fit, but buttoning that last button can be a trick. I'm going to focus my case study on the challenges of applying access restrictions to protect privacy rights at a presidential library. Specifically, my work with the Nixon presidential materials and what I've learned about other presidential libraries has raised questions for me concerning how the right of privacy should be applied to presidents of the United States and their papers, and how to balance these privacy protections against the need for maximum public access. Since I'm not a lawyer nor a privacy expert, my thinking has focused on practical ways of addressing these questions. I'd like to talk a little bit about my work with the Nixon presidential materials, the standards that presidential libraries have applied for protecting privacy rights, and the ethical challenges that these standards can pose. I see this talk more as raising questions than providing any answers, especially since I'm relatively new to the profession, and I look forward to hearing any responses you might have to these dilemmas. So if privacy protections vary for individuals based on how famous they are, few individuals, of course, are more famous than U.S. presidents and their families. As far as I know, presidential libraries have applied general privacy protection standards to their collections and have not developed specific standards for presidents and their families, which take into account a president's fame or any other factor. This is certainly the case for the Nixon Presidential Library. We use the general standard of restricting access to material that constitutes, quote, a clearly unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. And we apply this general standard to living individuals, whether presidents, members of their family, or anyone else. However, the unusual history of the Nixon presidential materials and our resulting unique processing procedures has meant that my colleagues and I spend extra time engaged with the concepts of the private and the personal. Let me give you a little background on the Nixon presidential materials to illustrate what I mean. In December 1974, 4 months after Richard Nixon resigned from office in the face of the Watergate investigation, Congress passed the Presidential Recordings and Materials Preservation Act, which gave the National Archives immediate custody of all papers and recordings of the Nixon White House. This was an unprecedented move in the handling of presidential papers. Up until that date, all White House files were considered the personal property of the retiring president, who could dispose of them as he wished. The basic rationale behind the new law was that presidential papers, which concerned public duties, should be preserved and made available to the public according to law, and not handled simply by the whim of an individual president. And I find it a little bit stunning that it took our country 200 years to get to that point. However, the National Archives soon recognized that a portion of the Nixon presidential materials in their custody concerned personal matters concerning President Nixon, his family, and the White House staff. The president and staff had not had the opportunity to segregate personal materials within the files, and the White House taping system had captured conversations indiscriminately, including personal family discussions between President Nixon and his wife and daughters about subjects that had no connection to their public activities. The National Archives, therefore, established regulations that provided for a review for ownership of the Nixon presidential materials during archival processing. Materials that concerned the constitutional and statutory duties of the president, defined in detail by 12 categories, were retained by the National Archives. Materials that did not concern the constitutional and statutory duties of the president were determined to be personal under the regulations and were to be returned to President Nixon or the appropriate staff member. Now, litigation between President Nixon and the National Archives hammered out processing regulations that more specifically defined this category of personal material in a number of ways. The most significant was that the personal material to be returned to President Nixon included matter that concerned individual political associations. In essence, the regulations distinguished between President Nixon's role as President of the United States and his role as head of the Republican Party. Material concerning the Republican Party and retail politics are considered personal. The only exception is made for material concerning any abuse of government power, which the National Archives retains the right to preserve and make available to the public. So archivists processing the Nixon presidential materials spend a significant amount of time thinking about and engaged with notions of public and personal spheres in reviewing the materials for ownership. Once ownership has been established, the archivists then apply privacy protections on the materials retained by the National Archives. Now that I've given you some background on the unique context in which Nixon Library archivists apply privacy protections, I want to explore some of the standards that the Nixon Library and other presidential libraries use to ensure privacy protections. And I want to discuss some of the challenges these standards raise, especially when applied to presidents and their families. As I mentioned, the Nixon Library, like other presidential libraries, use the general standard of restricting access to material that constitutes, quote, a clearly unwarranted invasion of personal privacy of a living person. This is a very general standard. It seems to me that it is essentially a standard based on the implicit assumption that there's a basic consensus out there among us about what is private in an individual's life. But I wonder to what extent this is true. It seems to me that ideas of privacy, at least among the wider public, have been changing rapidly in recent years. Media obsession with every detail of the lives of the famous, reality television, social networking websites like Facebook and MySpace seem to suggest that little remains private for individuals who take on even minor public roles. If ideas of privacy are changing, a general standard for privacy does have the virtue of not requiring revisions as the ideas about privacy change. The general standard assumes a consensus, and that consensus simply shifts with time. But changing ideas raises the question of whether a consensus truly exists. If some are more affected by the trends towards change, then maybe different age groups or different communities have differing ideas of what should be kept private. The very wording of the standard the presidential libraries use suggests to me ambiguities in the notion of privacy. Consider the wording of the standard a clearly unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. Four words, clearly, unwarranted, invasion, and personal, all modify the notion of privacy. Under this standard, the violation must be clear. It must be an invasion, a word with a heavy negative connotation. The term unwarranted suggests that some invasions of privacy may be justified, but the standard doesn't specify these grounds. Personal, hence that there are some forms of privacy which are not personal. In presidential libraries, we apply this general standard of privacy protection to presidents and their families, as well as to every other individual the presidential collections concern. As I said, to my knowledge, the presidential libraries have not implemented a privacy standard specific to all presidents and their families, and I wonder whether maybe we should try. Archivists widely acknowledge that famous individuals have fewer privacy rights than ordinary people. As I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, this is because famous people, by allowing themselves to become famous, in a sense voluntarily forfeit some of their privacy. Few individuals are more famous than presidents of the United States, so what should remain private for them? Should anything? If you consider the power of the president, the prominence that the personal character of the president has obtained in elections, and the need for voters to be well informed about their leaders in a democracy, I'd be interested to hear any reactions people might have. Another tough issue is presidential families. Famous those presidential families become, but sometimes it's a compelled fame. Their fame can be involuntarily coerced by aggressive media attention, but also in a sense by the presidents themselves. For example, Richard Nixon as president had a tendency to turn what some might consider his private family life into publicity opportunities. He once suggested to his chief of staff that a press release be sent out concerning his call to his son-in-law, Edward Cox, in which the president had congratulated his son-in-law on passing the bar exam. General privacy standards can be a challenge to apply with presidential collections, and I'm sure other archives face similar challenges. In the past, the National Archives has employed more specific privacy protection standard has employed the more specific privacy protection standard of restricting access to, quote, materials that tend to embarrass, damage, or harass. The Kennedy Presidential Library's processing manual still uses this harm standard to supplement the general standard NARA applies. Their manual sums up this harm standard by saying, quote, it's not our job to expose people or to hide anything that should be open to the public. We have to balance these two ideas, and we do this by adhering to the basic principle, we don't want to hurt anybody. This no harm standard is a great ideal, but I wonder whether it can be applied in all situations. Aren't there some instances in which, in order to open what should be available to the public, people must be exposed? Or on the other hand, in order to prevent exposing people, significant information is kept from the public. The law that Congress passed in 1974 governing the Nixon presidential materials declares that privacy rights cannot prevent materials from being released to the public which concern the abuse of government power. In other words, according to this law, people may be exposed so that information should be open to the public will not be hidden. Certainly, one can minimize any harm done by weighing the importance of access to particular materials and the severity of the personal exposure. But it seems to me that in some archives, at least, it is impossible to avoid all harm to either privacy or access. Even perfectly balanced decisions can do harm to someone's interests in some situations. Another more specific privacy protection standard employed in presidential libraries, and again this example comes from the Kennedy Library Processing Manual, is the standard of public knowledge. I found the standard challenging to apply in my own work because so much attention is focused on American presidents that gossip and accounts with dubious credibility abound, and these questionable accounts often make it into print and widespread public circulation. For example, does a single dubious allegation from an author who has made many unsubstantiated charges against a president constitute public knowledge if an archivist discovers very credible material to substantiate what at first appeared to be a doubtful slander? This kind of situation makes me think of the Whitewater investigation of the Clintons. Just about everything under the sun concerning the Clintons' personal finances were investigated by Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr, and all kinds of allegations were made. But ultimately, the Clintons were not charged with any misconduct. If an archivist at the Clinton Library were to uncover, and I stress this is just a hypothetical, if they were to uncover documents substantiating one of the wilder allegations of misconduct by a questionable source for the investigation, could the library open the material claiming the misconduct was already publicly known? If the answer is yes, this seems like an incentive to make wild charges against public figures about adultery, substance abuse, financial misconduct, whatever, out of the hope that it will allow archivists to open more material on the grounds of public knowledge. Well, by way of conclusion, balancing access and privacy rights, as the new Code of Ethics asks us to do, presents archivists with a series of challenges. It places us in a role that may make us uncomfortable as interpreters of records. We have to interpret what material is private, what material must be opened because of public interest. I'm inclined to believe that this role as interpreter is unavoidable to some degree, but it can be ethically challenging. Thank you.
So good afternoon, everybody. For the past 6 years, I've served as university archivist and director of records management at Appalachian State University. Appalachian is one of the 16 institutions that comprise the University of North Carolina, the best-known components being the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and North Carolina State University. Appalachian was founded in 1899 as a training institution for public school teachers and remained a teachers' college until the 1970s. In the past 35 years, the school has been transformed into a comprehensive state university, although its focus remains on undergraduate education, with a student population of some 16,000 and almost 800 faculty members. The campus is located in Boone, North Carolina, a town of some 15,000 residents, situated in the midst of the Blue Ridge, a little over 3,000 feet above sea level. The university's football stadium, known informally as the Rock, is the home of the Appalachian Mountaineers Division I AA football champions for the last 3 years, although we lost a game this afternoon to Louisiana State, currently ranked number 6. But we took home a lot of money. When I began thinking about the topic of this panel, researching relevant secondary sources and organizing my ideas, I found myself in a quandary. The organizers of this panel assumed that archivists invited to speak would address, quote, access to collection scenarios when they or their institutions have been placed in potential conflict with Section 6 of SAA's Code of Ethics. But as I continued my research and reading, I began to realize that during my tenure as university archivist, I have yet to be faced with a serious ethical dilemma concerning the provision of access to the records in my charge. Therefore, in this brief talk, I will try to explain why I have not found myself between the ethical rock and the access hard place that my colleagues at other types of institutions have confronted. And believe me, as a business archivist for the 5-6 of my career before I became entered academia and became a state employee, that was not the case. So this why is very important to me, and I want at the same time, I will try to make clear why my situation may be in some ways unique. As an employee of the state of North Carolina, My work and the work of all state employees is regulated by a public records law, chapters 121 and 132 of the North Carolina General Statutes. Passed in 1935 with major amendments in 1975 and 1995, this legislation unambiguously defines public records as, quote, all documents, papers, letters, maps, books, photographs, films, sound recordings, magnetic and other tapes, electronic data processing records, artifacts, and other documentary materials, regardless of physical forms or characteristics, made or received in the transaction of public business by any agency of North Carolina government. A later section of the law forthrightly defines the public's right to access these records. Quote, every custodian of public records shall permit any record in the custodian's custody to be inspected and examined at reasonable times and under reasonable supervision by any person and shall, as promptly as possible, furnish copies thereof. Moreover, quote, no person requesting public records shall be required to disclose the purpose or motive for the request. This is the legal anchor that all archivists and state service depend upon to guide their actions, in particular with regard to access. I have not had time to research the public record laws of every state, but I think it is clear that North Carolina's law is a particularly strong statute. Moreover, it is a law that ordinary citizens are aware of, as it is often at the center of controversies and legal actions, usually between investigative reporters for the major newspapers in the state and elected and appointed officials defending their administrative and political activities. So let us pause here for a moment and pay homage to this law's intellectual forebearers. And at this point, the postmodernists and the Enlightenment deniers among us may wish to jump ship and head for the exits. For we are about to enter a sea of ideas where the perfectibility of man is championed, truth may be found through empiricism, and the state, l'état, is seen as representing the best aspirations of its citizens. So the North Carolina public record law didn't suddenly spring into being in 1935. Rather, it reflects the notion that government should be accountable to its citizens. This is an idea of the Enlightenment, championed by, among others, Rousseau in The Social Contract, published in 1762. As Ernest Posner made clear 68 years ago, it's hard to believe, 68 years ago, in a seminal article, Some Aspects of Archival Development Since the French Revolution, government accountability was enshrined in the early days of the French Revolution through laws enacted by the French National Assembly. In particular, laws were passed that established the National Archives as a repository for government records with specific instructions that any French citizen might demand the right to inspect its holdings. The second intellectual strand of North Carolina's public records law is the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, another child of the Enlightenment, which, by guaranteeing freedom of speech and a free press, demands that government perform and document its functions in public and provide citizens and journalists with the means to judge its activities. Based on these broad principles, access to public records was then further strengthened and codified by the passage of federal and state freedom of information laws in the 1960s and 1970s. The North Carolina public records law, then, is a strong bulwark to the access clause of SAA's Code of Ethics. As state employees, archivists working within the University of North Carolina system not only, quote, strive to promote open and equitable access, we will provide access or be in violation of state law. Now, at the same time, other sections of the public records law and certain federal statutes clearly impose limits on my work. These laws do not directly limit access to records held in university archives. Instead, they provide a framework which regulates my collection activities to keep the university archives free of records that we are either prohibited from providing to researchers or that would impose an impossible burden on our resources to manipulate into usable formats through redaction and other means. These laws include sections of the public records law regulating disclosure of personnel records, for example, and two federal statutes, which I'm sure are tired of hearing about, the Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, or FERPA, and the Health Information Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA. Now, you may well ask, how can I implement this overall strategy of keeping the archives free of restricted records while still documenting the history of Appalachian State University? My answer may not satisfy you if you believe that a university archives must contain every form, letter, email, or database containing student or employee information. However, if you are of a more practical persuasion, then perhaps my approach will make sense. It is of great importance that you understand that my collection activities are immeasurably simplified because I also serve as the university's records manager. This means that I have knowledge of the whole universe of records from which to select those of enduring historical value. Moreover, I was on the committee of UNC records managers that wrote the new UNC General Records Retention Schedule, in which we struggled to bring the schedule up to date in a new era where electronic records are replacing the old paper-based systems and providing guidance to series of records covered under FERPA and HIPAA. This experience has clearly shaped my overall documentation strategy for acquiring university records in several important ways. First, the North Carolina public records law exempts certain large series of records from disclosure. Some of these series are rather arcane, such as, quote, the trade secrets furnished to a state agency in connection with a state contract, unquote, and are easily managed. When contracts are scheduled to come to the Records Center from offices and departments, we note that the trade secrets exemption and restrict any files containing such records. If contract files are eventually transferred to the archives, the restriction carries over. The restricted files are listed in the finding aid, giving the researcher the opportunity to contact the individual or company owning the trade secret if they wish to gain access to specific documents. However, some series of records exempted from disclosure under the public records law are so inclusive that we employ a different strategy. For example, the Records Center regularly receives the personnel files of terminated employees from our Human Resources Department. Because of obvious privacy concerns, these records are restricted, and the UNC General Schedule calls for their retention for 30 years following the employee's termination from university service, after which they may be destroyed. But the public records law also demands that certain employment data be open to the public, including name, age, date of original employment, current salary, position classification, and other job-related information. These records are problematic for inclusion in the university archives for several reasons. Although they are a rich source for understanding who worked for the university in the past, both individually and in aggregate, I have decided to keep them under permanent retention in the Records Center. This solves several problems. First, ownership of the records stored in the Records Center remains with the transferring department or office. This means that it is the responsibility of the department to manage requests for information contained in the files and to respond to requests for personal information allowed under the public records law. Personnel records will only be transferred to the archives after 40 years and or the death of the employee. We will then be able to open the records for research free from privacy concerns or the need to review and redact certain information. My approach to the records that fall under FERPA and HIPAA restrictions is generally to keep them out of the archives and the record center, and thereby leaving the creating offices to enforce confidentiality. This includes large series of records once found in the archives of private colleges and universities, records recording student admission and achievement, financial aid records, student health records. For example, records of admission and achievement are now centralized and maintained by the university registrar through a large database, the Student Information System, or SIS. And this is pretty much clear the way it works in all 16 campuses of the University of North Carolina. Now, these records include applications for admission, letters of recommendation, high school transcripts, test scores, class enrollment and grades, certification of graduation, and transcripts. These records are all restricted under FERPA and are kept by the registrar permanently in the SIS. Although giving up claims to these records for half a century may seem a poor way of documenting the history of the university, I believe firmly that this is the correct course of action. First, keeping responsibility for the SIS at arm's length protects the university archives from the inadvertent release of student information protected by FERPA. Second, the university archives will eventually inherit the legacy data in the SIS following the student's death or after a reasonable presumption, in this case 60 years, of longevity. Third, the university archives collects and actively manages the so-called directory information about students that FERPA allows, place and date of birth, address, telephone number, dates of attendance, and honors and awards. Hence, we know who our students are and were. Fourth, we have a specific strategy for documenting student life through the careful preservation and indexing of campus newspaper and yearbooks, that is, material that's published, through the harvesting and maintenance of the university's website, and through the collection of other university publications. We also encourage alumni to contribute collections of letters, photographs, and diaries to the university archives, and to participate in our oral history program. Fifth, we collect the records of student organizations, including fraternities and sororities, athletic teams, and clubs of all kinds and purposes. Finally, the university's Office of Institutional Research conducts myriad studies and surveys of our students using this information as the basis for reports to the chancellor and the system's general administration on a wide range of subjects regarding student behavior and achievement. We actively collect these reports for inclusion in the university archives. I use the same approach in dealing with student health records and with student financial aid records. The former are covered under HIPAA, which extends privacy indefinitely, and that's an important point. Hence, these records remain in the Student Health Center and are destroyed when their retention period elapses. The latter are transferred to the Record Center, maintained for 3 years after the student graduates, and are then destroyed by shredding to prevent identity theft. Information lost is compensated for by reports from the Office of Institutional Research, which regularly study the social and economic background of the ASU student body. In conclusion, as a university archivist employed by a North Carolina State University, I've never found myself in an ethical dilemma concerning access to the records in our archives. I attribute this to the state's meaningful and well-defined public records law, which demands that access be granted to our records except in unusual and well-defined circumstances. In cases where records are restricted from disclosure under the public records law or protected under FERPA Our overall strategy is to keep these records out of the archives until the restrictions are moot because of death. Regarding records that fall under HIPAA's privacy rights, our policy is to reject acquisition since privacy rights to personal health information is not extinguished by death. That leaves student financial records, which, although we could acquire after death, we have decided not to collect on the basis that the privacy of a family's finances, even after the passage of many years, should be respected. Thank you.
Okay. I promised our speakers that they would each have a chance to react to each other's comments before we opened the floor to questions, and I don't know if any of them do. No, just well, then I'm going to ask one brief question of all of them and then open the floor to questions because I have that power as chair, right? I can ask the first question. I was going back and listening, you know, listening to each of you talk about the decisions you made relative to collections in your institution, and it seemed to me that the decisions and the process of making that decision was very much based internally within your own institution, not considering the SAA Code of Ethics at all. Do you find that when you look at these issues, I mean, you were asked to think about it because that's the topic of the session, but in reality, and this is where theory hits the road, is the SAA Code of Ethics relevant to you in your work, and is there something that would have made it relevant?
Well, I think the Code of Ethics is something that we would want to strive for and that we do strive for, and I think that the Code of Ethics sort of, I don't know, to me, I think we're already living that Code of Ethics in that we're striving for access and we're striving to have things open as much as possible while respecting confidentiality and other aspects that we would need to respect. And so I think in terms of our pulling out a file and checking it, no. It's more, especially for us, we're a private university and we're going to access our rules and regulations that apply specifically to our case. So I guess what I'm going to wire around to say is basically that it's already internalized in some regards.
Well, I guess I would say that's one of the value that I found from this session is that being involved in this session, I've definitely thought much more about how the Code of Ethics applies to my work. Frankly, I spend so much time trying to keep track of all the legislation and litigation that affects my institution's processing that usually ends up dominating my thinking about processing materials. So I think it'll be useful for our staff and maybe presidential libraries in general to think more about how the new Code of Ethics applies and some of the ways in which maybe it's not always helpful and doesn't answer all of our questions.
And I would just like to add that the Code of Ethics not only contains Section 6, but also contains Section 9, law. Archivists must uphold all federal, state, and local laws. So I think that that's important to remember, too, that it's always a balancing act.
Thank you. Okay, I'd like to open this to the floor. And this is being recorded, so I will attempt to repeat the questions after the person asks them. Joe.
Susan, you mentioned in the opening that there's a joint FLA SAA task force on access. Actually, three members of the task force, myself, Donald Weber, Donald Friedman, and Tim Murray are here today. We put on the archives listserv a working draft of the access policy. We will mount within the next couple weeks on the SAA web draft, and we'll also send out a message on the listserv alerting people to that and looking for comments. We expect to be able to present to SAA Council and ALA Board by next spring a policy for them to consider. So if you have any comments, if anyone would like to talk to us after this meeting, we'll hang around for a few minutes. But please look at the draft. It will be on the web. If you have comments, send them to us, and then we will consider them and work on final revision.
Okay. Let me reiterate what Joe said. This is Joe Anderson. The joint SAA-ALA committee that I referred to in my opening, that's revisiting the, what's the title of it again? Access statement for that relates to stuff is being revisited, and a new draft was circulated to the archives listserv and will be posted to the web, and they're looking for comments. My question is the one that will be posted to the web, will it have the old and the new so you can see the changes? Because the one that came through on the website, you couldn't see that.
Yeah, that got a little hard to know.
So you will be able to see how the change has evolved. You won't.
Right.
Okay.
Because that was sent out as an email.
Right.
Well, now it was clear
right.
By the time you received
it. Because it's interesting, because you can't just look at this on its own. I mean, it's interesting to look at a document that was 10 years old and see how it's changed and see how. The issue of electronic records has changed how we look at it or what goes up on the web or anything like that, how access is being defined differently than it was the last time these things were revisited. Elizabeth.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Joe. As I remember, that was a statement on access to manuscript materials. Is it still about manuscript materials, or has it become more generic?
Well, I don't think I would answer any questions here because I've read it through a few times. My memory is it's now on archive itself. Tim or Donna,
the title of it is Joint Statement on Access to Original Research Materials. That's what the title of the document is. So it doesn't specifically say manuscripts, it just says research materials. Yes.
A general comment or question for the panel. I'd like for them sort of to see how they handle this kind of scenario. One of the things we strive for is equal access, not to privilege one class of user above the other. Yet I know as a university archivist at the president's office calls, I don't care who else is in the reading room or what else is in the line, they all of a sudden get to the head of the line. And I know each of you probably have a privileged class there, so I wonder how in that sort of, when striving for equal access, how you sort of balance that kind of request for maybe a donor or some other kind of privileged class.
Okay, let me try to repeat that. The question is that we strive, the question revolves around striving to provide equal access to all kinds, all categories of users, but what happens when the president of the university has a request or some important donor, do you privilege that person or how do you factor that in?
Well, at the Hartman Center, the J. Walter Thompson Company and the Outdoor Advertising Association of America are paying customers. We are their business archives, and therefore if they call with a question or a reference request, they do get bumped to the line, to the head of the line. But the way that we deal with that is that, one, we have a great staff, and so it's not just me. So if, JWT Detroit calls and they want 50 years of truck advertising copies, then it's not just me and a student who are doing that plus trying to answer other questions. We can get the whole staff involved, and we can triage and say, okay, this is what's going on. This is what is already in the pipeline. This I know is coming up in the pipeline, and here we have JWT. So how are we going to be able to provide access and provide to the answers in a timely manner to everyone? I would not say on an equal basis, but in a timely way. And I think we do a pretty good job about that. And we're upfront with our customers. If a patron calls and they want something, then I can honestly say it is going to be a few days before I'm able to answer that because of something else that's in the pipeline ahead of you.
Yeah, let me just add to that. And that is that in my experience, both as a business archivist and as a university archivist, The one area where I've found that the work is exactly the same is this issue, which I've really come to see less as deciding who's more privileged than the other. It's really more of a time management issue for the archivist, particularly a lone arranger. And that is you always have more demands on your time than you have time. And so if the president of the company calls, if the chancellor of the university calls, if the top administrator at the hospital calls, nodding to Dawn over here, that because they're institutional archives. They're all set within a larger setting with people above you who expect you to provide them with fairly fast turnaround on their requests. And that's just part of the territory of being an archivist. And you just need to be able to understand that all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others, and just deal with it and get on with it and not really worry about it otherwise and trying to figure out if I'm going to have to stay an extra 2 hours at work to get this reference request finished.
Just real quickly, my responsibilities don't really encompass dealing with some of these questions, although one class of special researchers that the Nixon Presidential Library does have to deal with are government historians who do have special access to collections that general researchers don't have, and they just have a privileged status that other researchers do not.
Okay, let me repeat that. The question was posed to Hal at Appalachian State. What happens if, let's say, FERPA changed and the privacy did no longer ceased at death, but as with HIPAA goes on, how would you handle that? Would you deaccession records? What would you do?
Actually, there's an excellent model for this, and Tim Pyatt, who's sitting behind you, is sort of an expert on this story. And that is that there were medical records, a very important series of medical records, that had been transferred from the department into the Record Center and from the Record Center into the state archives. And that was the records of our eugenics commission. The state of North Carolina, like several other states, the United States, in a dark chapter of American medical history, conducted experiments and then actually had a campaign of sterilization for certain classes of individuals who they felt that society needed to be. This was a way of protecting society from a genetic strain. I'm doing a very poor job of explaining this, but those records were open, and several of the state's larger newspapers had begun to ask for and began to investigate these records. When HIPAA was passed, the state archives was faced with this massive need to redact all the records which were previous to this were open for inspection. And so what they decided to do, and there was a lot of controversy about this, but it was really the only thing they could do, was that they deaccessioned the records from the state archives back to the Department of Health that had transferred them originally. And they were taken out of a certain status, if you will, because records of state archives were open for public inspection, back to the department, and the department could then restrict them under HIPAA. And it also got the archives out of the redacting business. And although they actually, the state archives continued to redact records for the Department of Health, the ownership of the records and the cost of all this, at least the state archives was able to get out from under a huge burden. So in a sense, that's the model that I would use, that if all of a sudden records, student records that we've, legacy student records that we've acquired, if they were all of a sudden to be covered by a net, I would consider transfer them right back to the registrar and let them be dealt with as protected student records thenceforward. It is a problem, but and certainly the HIPAA was, it created incredible problems for not just the state archives but other institutions which held this sort of material and expected, that on death that those rights would be extinguished.
I would also suggest that happens even without changes in state law. And we've talked in a couple of sessions about the effect of MPLP on what you know about materials when you provide access to them. And so that collections are out there, the barn door is open, researchers have seen them, they've been used and cited, and whoops, all of a sudden you find things in them that should never have been outed in the first place. Sometimes, and that's by statute. I had experiences of that when I was at the Wisconsin Historical Society, where one series in a juvenile facility was closed by statute because it was related to juveniles, yet the administrator's subject files and correspondence were not, but the same kind of case material that was in the student files and the inmate files were in the administrator's files, and that was not closed by statute and had been open. And the question being, once that's already been out there, can you turn around then and say, whoops, no, nobody can see it anymore when it's already been seen? And I don't know if that resonates with anybody in the audience or on the panel. I didn't mean to stop that dead in the tracks. Nancy.
I have one other question.
Okay, so the follow-up question to SAR has to do with shifts in definitions in talking about privacy from individual privacy to personal privacy, individually identifiable information versus personal privacy. Am I getting that correct?
Yes. What is the distinction?
Well, I'm not sure there's a whole lot I can say to speak to that, except that in talking about those various words that our general standard for privacy uses to modify privacy, modifying privacy always struck me as somewhat redundant and not particularly useful, and potentially really what was meant by personal or more useful way of thinking about personal privacy is actually thinking about it as individual, that there are various types of privacy. Privacy protecting individuals, privacy protecting institutions, you know, confidentiality, and that thinking of personal instead of some kind of vague amorphous personal sphere versus a public sphere, thinking about privacy as protecting individual, you know, information about individuals may be a more useful way. But that's about all I can add to that discussion, I think. But I'd be interested to hear what other people think.
Questions? There's got to be more questions. Okay, this question was for Lynn about the Duke collections and to talk a little more about the other options, the other choices that you could have made to handle the collections besides the one you did choose.
That's a very good question. Some of the options would have been to try and talk to whoever could have been deemed the donor and talk about their views on it, work with them to get to some point of restrictive acceptability. And the concerns there were that they would possibly remove the collection in its entirety or remove parts of it. There was no funding with the collection, and so it is a huge collection, and to have to go through and discern what is and what is not within a questionable framework for a specific business would take a lot of time and a lot of thought, and that was not really within a realistic, I guess, that couldn't be done. One option would be to close it entirely. That would not have worked with the standards that we were working under, the processing standards. I guess it could have been done, but it would have gone against the institutional framework of what we were working in. Those were the main one, or to leave it open. I mean, we could have left it open. The concern there is that, and I don't mean to keep reiterating this, is that the responsibility that we felt that we had towards the business organization. And it would have been the same if it had been a person, but because we're trying to build a business archive to provide access, and not only just access, but to provide helpful helpful access, helpful description, helpful access, timely access to material, and to work with businesses who are reticent about having their materials out there. And, I mean, I think they have a legitimate reason for being hesitant about having material out for the public to see, because it's their business. There's a lot of things that go on in business that are ugly. There's a lot of things that goes on in academia that's ugly, but and thus things are closed. So it's that sort of fine line that we were walking, and that's why we came to the decision that we came to. But those were the other options: open it, close it, possibly take it, have it taken back, or have to go through and basically process it.
Something that came up in one of your comments that I made a note of, and I'd like to ask you and throw that out to the rest of you, is do you think the expectations have changed? Do you think the standards of, you know, with all that information out there on Facebook and all of these other places, do we look at what is potentially personal or confidential information differently than we used to? We set standards on collections we processed a while ago or negotiations with donors, but do we look at that differently now, and should we?
Jason? Well, I think that ties into something that Sarah was saying, which is, you know, you talk about how there isn't a real consensus now about privacy in general in the public because of social network and reality TV. And my concern there is that people might start to assume more and more that, well, the public just doesn't really care about privacy anymore, which will lead to more invasions of their personal privacy. On the other hand, you hear anecdotal information coming out of the Bush administration, for example, where at one point Bob Woodward wrote about Andrew Card keeping information about how he was doing his job in a quote-unquote personal notebook that he bought at a drugstore, under the idea that because it was bought by him personally, it was therefore private and therefore protected. So on the one hand, you might have this risk where the general public's getting less privacy. On the other hand, you've got public officials sort of working the language to try to get things private that really maybe aren't meant to be that.
I should have passed the microphone back there for you. Yes?
Another idea on that is, in my situation, institutional archives, there has been some drawback from administration that in an internet age where more people are finding descriptions to records, they're more concerned that even descriptions of restricted records, or maybe records that might have restricted elements to them, be taken down in a way, just as we're trying to push more of these descriptions onto the web.
That's an interesting other side to this, to repeat what was said in the back of the room. I'm sorry, I should be running around passing the mic. That with some concerns over privacy, that there is pressure from our resource allocators, this is a business setting, right, to actually remove descriptions of materials that are considered to have some risk from access, not just the materials themselves, but if you don't have the description, people are less likely to find them and ask for them, and that's even potentially a step backwards. Yes, Richard.
Susan, just a quick note as regards to the Andrew Card diary. There is conflicting case law that a personal diary kept as an agent member that is never shared with anyone is sometimes treated as a personal record, not a government record, even though it may pertain to government business. But it is, I want to emphasize, there's conflicting case law.
So case law, where is this? What is this law?
Yeah, the case law means decisions in courts.
Okay, was this an Arizona thing, or? Yeah, Richard is pointing out that there have been examples in case law where a personal diary kept even by a public official, but if it was kept for purely personal reasons, even if it had some content in it that was government-related, would be considered personal. Did I get that correct?
Yes, but
there's conflicting case law on that. Thank you. Elizabeth.
And I would just add that I've heard, I'm no expert on this, but
Actually, I had a conversation with our senior general counsel, Ward, who used to work for the White House. So, you know, we had a conversation about this whole issue of what is and is not a record. He was amazed when he came to Ford and found out that senior executives could actually destroy records because it came from the environment where you could destroy records. And from what he said, if anyone refers to those notes, they've taken them to jog their memory, right?
Right.
And if you're then having a conversation with others, and you refer to those notes in order to refresh everyone else's memory, then those are subject to government.
Okay, what Elizabeth was pointing out, and this is Ford counsel, that, you know, to further wrinkles to this, that if these notes were then used as a memory refresher and came into some other kind of discussion, right, then all of a sudden they did cross the line. Doing this a while ago, and I apologize. I'm a bad chair.
The example you gave about the eugenic records has made me question what your position is on the ethics of the archivist to provide access to records when it is, you know, legally allowable. Because under HIPAA, that material can be made accessible for research. So I would like to ask you, you know, how someone could have access to those eugenic records for the purpose of research at this time. Because many archives have, you know, eugenics records, and there are many researchers out there who are studying this now.
I didn't mean to suggest that they were not accessible. Mm-hmm. They're just not accessible in the format that they were originally. That is that they may be used for research, but they need to be redacted. All the personal information needs to be removed so that you can do a aggregate studies and you can count, but it's the names and the family connections which are privileged under HIPAA.
No, under HIPAA, a researcher can obtain an institutional waiver of authorization to look at the original material. It doesn't have to be redacted.
That's correct, but that person has to be, you know, a certified researcher with a bona fide project, all right, so that if you walk in or if I walk in and ask to see those records, the only way I can see them is if they are in a redacted form.
Yeah, but they're still accessible for research, I mean, not for, you know, just casual reference. But I mean, who would make a decision?
But it's also, you know, incumbent upon the researcher then, you know, to guarantee that personal information will not be released, and actually they're held responsible if it would be, if their notes or if documents that have been copied that contain personal information then come, then that is a problem for the researcher, and it's the researcher's burden, you know, to protect that information as well.
Yeah, well, that's the purpose of an institutional waiver. You know, once that's granted, the responsibility is then placed on the researcher.
Maybe you should identify yourself so that people understand this dialogue a little better.
And I'd also like to ask Tim to weigh in here because he has a good deal of information on this issue.
Yeah. Alan, are we both on the stage?
Can Nancy introduce herself first? Because I think people don't know her, don't understand the context.
Yeah, I'm asking these questions. I'm Nancy McCall from the Medical Archives at Johns Hopkins, and so we have to live and breathe HIPAA every day.
And Nancy wrote the article, if not the articles, right? Which I have somewhere in my notes.
Okay. Did you?
Yeah. Hal and I were on the State Historical Records Board in North Carolina together when this issue came up. And I think the one issue that, part of the problem is this was right at the beginning of the law, and so the state of North Carolina really didn't have a good procedure. And unlike a university, there wasn't like an institutional review board for that kind of process to go through. And I think that's part of the problem because this is a government agency. And so the State Archives sort of figured that giving it back to the Department of Health, which was used to dealing for requests for restricted health information, that was basically the rationale behind this decision. So I think that's sort of the short answer.
Right. And the remember that most of the requests for information were not for research. They were investigative reporters who actually wanted to trace individuals who may had a claim, a monetary claim. And so, you know, our friends in the Fourth Estate felt that they were pursuing justice here, as indeed they were. And at the same time, you have a law conflicting, you know, that they cannot, that their investigations under those terms could not be allowed. So there, it's a different thing from research in that sense, that they were not doing aggregate studies looking for patterns and trends that were going to be published. What they were doing was trying to identify individuals who may have a claim against the state.
More questions, comments, thoughts? I'm supposed to remind you, I've forgotten lots of other things today, but I'm supposed to remind you that there's an evaluation form in the back of the on-site program, and your program committee would like to have some feedback on these sessions. And I'd like to thank our panelists again for staying till the end of the meeting, and thank you for staying till the end of the meeting and for all your discussion. Thank you.